This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The world famous, okay, regional famous, all right, locally famous, all right, famous in our own minds, Hard Traveling Fanboys Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Greg Phillips. With me as always, my partner, my companion, the Bucky to my Steve Rogers, or the Steve Rogers to my Bucky, Nick Duke. How are you, Nick?
I'm doing pretty well. I think I'd probably be the Bucky. You're the more clean cut of the two of us, I would say.
That's true. Although occasionally I do defect to the other side.
Oh, that's some foreshadowing for later on in the show, I think.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Rundown. This is our monthly look at the news and notes in and around the world of comics. We talk heavily about movie news, TV news, comic book news, toy line news, whatever, headline news, whatever you want to talk about, as long as it has to do with the world of comic books.
I think we actually got a little video game news this week as well. So that's
exciting. We do. We got some video game news. We do. And I actually have a big announcement to make of my own, and I'm going to make it right here and right now. I don't even know if you know about this yet, Nick, but I have to make this announcement because it's been 4 long years, and after 4 long years away, I'm here to announce I'm returning to the Octagon this fall.
Oh, to the Octagon.
Right.
And the Octagon, of course, being the nickname you have for your penis.
That's right. For the first time in 4 years, I'm going to see it this fall. You wait. Just you wait. I'll actually be meeting in the Octagon the legendary Don the Predator Fry. That's right. On a video game called UFC Undisputed 2. So look for that coming this August on placetobenation.com.
That's nothing if not topical. But you're talking about the world of professional wrestling and mixed martial arts, and that's not what we're here to talk about. So
No, we're here to talk about the much more realistic world of comic books. We're here to talk about speed forces, hyper time, multiverses, infinite multiverses. We're here to talk about all kinds of crap.
The monitor and the anti-monitor, of course.
That's exactly right. The astral plane will be mentioned in this podcast.
It actually will be mentioned in this podcast. That's not even a joke.
Nope. So let's get cracking with our weekly segment here that we start the show with every week. And of course it is, hey, what you reading and what you watching? Tell us what you reading and what you watching. That's the best I got. That sucks, and that's the best I got.
That's
somebody
true.
Come in and help us out.
Oh, really?
But this is our segment, Reading and Watching, where we talk about what we're reading and what we're watching. And this week, it's all about, in the reading portion anyhow, DC Universe Rebirth, the 4 Rebirth titles that came out this past week, which would be Superman Rebirth number 1, Batman Rebirth number 1,
not Batman. You mean Batman
Rebirth number 1.
Green Arrow Rebirth.
Rebirth number 1. And of course, Green Lanterns number 1, featuring co-written by our hero, Mr. Geoff Johns. Now, the first thing I want to start out with is trying to get to the bottom of why comic book companies feel the need to number one-shots. Just kind of a weird thing. What do you think, Nick?
You know, I don't know why they do that either. I guess for cataloging purposes would be the only thing I can think of. Although I think there's something to perhaps, what if you know, we talked about this being the opening salvo in a story that's eventually building to something else. Could it be possible these Rebirth titles will get another installment down the road?
Perhaps they're bookends. Perhaps this is one end of the bookend and the other is the Spinneroony end of the bookend.
Ooh, I always like that one.
Yep. Now, we'll go ahead and get started with this. How many of these Rebirth titles this week did you actually get your hands on and get to read?
I picked up all of them except Superman. And I actually, you know, what happened was I turned in my pull list a couple weeks ago, my new pull list. That was kind of me just, you know, making my best guess at the stuff I would want to read. And then after last week's phenomenal release of DC Universe Rebirth, I'm so on board with this new direction that I think I'm going to wind up trying most of, if not all of the Rebirth one-shots and using those as guiding lights towards what my new pull list is eventually going to look like. But because Superman wasn't on my list, I didn't get that one because, and this is fantastic news, I'm not even upset. Apparently these things are selling like gangbusters. My shop today, you know, granted they've been down a few days now. I was out of town last week, so I wasn't able to go on Wednesday and pick them up. So I went, this is Monday, the Monday following as we record this. And when I went, there were no Rebirth books, whether it was DC Universe Rebirth or any of the solo Rebirths to be had. He had sold every single copy and actually said he had already sold all of his pre-sold all of his second printings of DC Universe Rebirth, had already ordered third printings and was going to second printings on all of the solo books as well.
Hey, that's a good problem to have, you know. I know that just recently, we're not going to get to this in our rundown segment, but Ben Percy, the writer of Green Arrow Rebirth, just mentioned on Twitter today, actually, as of this recording, that his issue of Green Arrow Rebirth moved 90,000 copies, which would make it the biggest selling Green Arrow comic of the modern era, even outselling Kevin Smith's debut back.
You would have to go back, I assume, to the Mike Grell days when the print industry was completely, completely different than it is now to find numbers like this. It's incredible, especially for a book that when I was looking at today, the comp numbers on it were about 27,000, 26,000, 25,000 for the last few issues of the New 52. So, I mean, and that's Green Arrow. That's not Superman or Batman selling that. That's Green Arrow. I would think of the four, you would have to think it would probably be the least selling one because it's the one that's not Superman or Batman, and it's the one that doesn't have Geoff Johns' name attached to it. So for that to be selling 90,000 copies, you got to be thinking when the top 10 books of the month come out, we're probably going to be looking at a pretty heavily dominated slate by DC, I would have to think, because you still got Greg Rucka, Wonder Woman coming up. You've got the Flash Rebirth. You've got Titans Rebirth. You've got a lot of things that people are really excited about still coming down the pipe. So,
yeah, absolutely. Should be interesting. The return of Action and Detective Comics to their old numbering,
right?
Coming up this
Which
week.
Those are the ones I'm really interested to see how they perform sales wise because it's not going to have the added boost.
It won't have
the
Rebirth effect. You're right. Yep.
So those will be interesting. I'm probably going to pick both of those up as well just to see. I'm planning on pulling Detective because the concept sounds interesting to me, and I'm going to give Action at least a chance to hook me. So we'll see if it does.
Well, now that we've talked about the financial ramifications, you obviously have read all of them except Superman. I've read all four. I picked up all four ahead of time. I'm actually going to end up getting almost all of the Rebirth one-shots. Not all of them, but almost all of them. So let's just get cracking. I thought all four were good books. There wasn't a bad book in the bunch. They were all solid. I think for the most part, they all did what they were trying to do. The winner for me, it's almost a co-winner because I thought the two that were ahead of the pack were Green Arrow Rebirth and Green Lanterns Rebirth. I thought those two were the leaders in the clubhouse, so to speak. That's not disparaging the other two, because Superman was very good, and I thought Batman was pretty good. But I think there was just something about this Green Arrow that felt fresh to me. It was the Green Arrow and Oliver Queen that we really haven't seen in a while, and it felt almost like an episode of Justice League Unlimited, which I really enjoyed. I loved the characterization of Dinah Lance. I loved
who's in the book, by the way. We should not skip past that. These two characters seem to be getting ready for a long term association with each other of some form or fashion. So that's exciting news.
I would highly recommend. I know it's hard to get your hands on it right now because it's sold out. But at most places. But if you can get your hands on this Green Arrow book, give it a try, because it's not, if you're primarily familiar with the television show Arrow, it's probably not going to be up your alley. But if you're familiar with if you want a different take on Oliver, a more comedic take, a more social justice kind of take on Oliver Queen.
I would say this is the closest in tone that a Green Arrow book has been probably since the Kevin Smith run. It's the most similar to that version of the character that I've seen.
This has got a lot of Kevin Smith similarities in it. There's a little bit of Mike Grell in there too.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. I really enjoyed that one. And then Green Lantern's tremendous.
That was the star of the week for me. I mean, I liked the Green Arrow book a great deal as well. I liked the Batman book probably more than you did. Didn't read the Superman book, obviously. But it's just the way that Geoff Johns knows how to pace a story. And when you combine that with Ethan Van Sciver drawing Hal Jordan again, I'm it's gonna do everything for me, and it did, man. It was fantastic. I love the concept they're setting up of having Jessica Cruz and Simon Baz fused into one power battery, so that they are dependent on each other. I like that. I like seeing Atrocitus come back in a big bad way. I like teasing some more Hal Sinestro interaction. I like just about everything that happened in this book. Loved the scene at the beginning or near the beginning where Simon Baz is having to scrub off the graffiti from his sister's garage where they've spray painted terrorists on his garage. Very topical with everything that's going on in the world today. I mean, can't say enough great things about that book, man. It was really, really well done, and it's got me excited to see where they take this character going forward. And I'll be honest, one of the big surprises of the book was she's been featured in Justice League for a little over a year now, but I thought this single issue did more to flesh out Jessica Cruz as a character than any of the work Johns did with her in Justice League, mainly because he had a larger cast to deal with there. But getting into some of her anxiety issues, the way she interacts with her family, there are a lot of really, really good things going on here that I enjoyed a whole lot. And this instantly shoots this title up near the top of my most anticipated going forward.
Yeah, there's a scene in that book where she's at the stands at a soccer practice, I think it is, and her interior monologue is just explaining to you how much she'd rather be anywhere else in the world than around people. And I think for a lot of us, we can relate to that.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting way of portraying her anxiety. And we've never really seen a Green Lantern like that before.
Right.
Every Green Lantern has been to some degree outgoing.
And cocky, almost yep. Headsure, to a certain degree.
In their own way. Cocky in their own way, exactly.
And I loved how they played it because they had her sister make reference to the fact that she'd been trying to get Jessica out of the apartment for like 3 years. And apparently she hadn't really left the apartment very much, if at all, in that time. So.
Yeah, they did a really good job of illustrating Jessica's quirks and also her sister's quirks. I think her sister's going to be a really cool supporting character. And setting up two rookie Green Lanterns working together, because traditionally...
And working together with the Justice League training them instead of the Corps. That's another really interesting aspect that I'm looking forward to seeing how that is explored.
Traditionally, the dynamic for the Green Lantern Corps has always been the veteran with the rookie. And it's going to be really interesting to see two rookies forced together. And, yeah, the art was great. And I'm actually really excited to see what Sam Humphries does with the book, because, to his credit, I couldn't tell what parts were written by Jeff and which parts were written by him.
Right, right. I kind of got the impression that I think Jeff probably scripted story a lot, and I think the actual writing of it was probably left up to Sam Humphries. But that's just my impression. I don't have any fact to back that up. It's just a blind speculation on my part.
Yeah, so we've talked a little bit about Green Arrow and Green Lanterns, which were our favorites of the week, respectively. Those were definitely my top two. But let's talk a little bit about Batman. I know we kind of had maybe different perspectives on it. I didn't think it was bad. I don't want to trash it anyway. It was actually right. Good. All of these books were good.
Right.
It was good. It just, for me, I thought there were two things that kind of held it back for me. Number one, I thought that it didn't do a great job of being a hook for new readers, in terms of they didn't really exactly what Green Arrow and Green Lanterns did, which was tell you who these characters are and why you should care about them. I don't think they did anything to tell me why I should care about Duke Thomas, who appears to be
that would be the one criticism I can agree with, because the Batman mythos is so well known in popular culture today that most of those characters don't need a hook, but Duke Thomas does. I'll agree with that.
You don't need to introduce people to Batman,
right? But that being said, I actually like the way Duke Thomas was written in the book. You know, having that prior experience with him, you know, through a few issues of We Are Robin that I read, and of course his introduction in the Snyder and Capullo series. And I really dug the new costume. They teased giving him the idea of Batman trying something that isn't necessarily the old Batman and Robin dynamic all over again. Mm-hmm. Liked all of that and loved their reinterpretation of Calendar Man.
Yeah,
thought that was one of the best things.
And almost a horror take on Calendar Man.
Calendar Man, yes, exactly. The concept basically being that Calendar Man is a guy who ages with every season, and then at the end sheds his skin and is reborn anew in the spring, much like you know, a flower or what have you. So like that a lot. And I'm going to tell you one thing I loved, and I didn't know I was going to love it as much as I did. I thought the art in this book was fantastic. I thought it was great Batman art, and if this is what we're going to get going forward, it will be a worthy successor to the run of Greg Capullo. So
yeah, I agree. The art was really good. Mikael Janin did that, I believe, and he's really good. And I was impressed. I was really impressed by the artwork, the way that it flowed and told the story and maintained good characterizations. I love the way he draws Bruce. I love the way he draws even Lucius Fox.
Yeah, it was good. That was good, yeah.
Drawn really well. I really dig Calendar Man because it's almost like a David Cronenberg take on Calendar Man.
Yep.
And I really like it. So I was impressed with a lot of that.
And it's just a great idea because, you know, Calendar Man's one of those few Batman villains that isn't beloved so much that you can't change him, you know? Because a lot of these characters, if you make drastic changes to them, you're gonna hear people complain. I mean, even someone like Black Mask, I heard so many people complain that Snyder and Capullo gave him a bondage mask instead of the wooden mask, and I don't understand why that's even a concern. But luckily with Calendar Man, I haven't heard any real backlash from that just yet.
And also, I think we would both agree that Calendar Man is maybe one of the most underutilized Batman villains in general.
Yeah.
He's obviously part of one of the ultimate all-time Batman stories in The Long Halloween.
Right.
But other than that, nobody's really touched him for a significant story.
You know, other than The Long Halloween, you know what the best usage of Calendar Man is?
The Arkham games.
Arkham City. When he's in the basement of the courthouse for the entire game, and every time you go see him, he has something creepy to say. That's the best usage of Calendar Man we've had since Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale. So,
yeah.
But what about Superman? You know, I didn't get to read that one, but I heard. I mean, the buzz online for that one made it sound like it might have been the best of the four. But
it was excellent. It was really good. For anybody that's read Peter Tomasi and Patrick Gleason's work on Batman and Robin, I can already tell this book is going to have a lot of similarities to that, because the one word I would pick out to describe this book would be heart. That's what it's built on. The same way that their Batman and Robin run was built on heart, because this issue is not so much dealing with the father and son dynamic that the main title is going to deal with. This was very much a closure to the New 52 Superman, and in that regard, it worked a lot better than Superman 52 did. This was a farewell to that version of Superman and a re-welcoming of this pre-Flashpoint Superman, telling audiences who he is, why he matters, and basically summing up what Superman is in one comic. And they did. I don't want to spoil it for people that haven't read it, but pick this up. Even if you're not a Superman fan, pick this up and give it a try, because it really distills the heroic ideal of Superman. Because
like I said, I mean, I'm not the world's biggest Superman fan, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to pick this up, whether it be, you know, in print through the second printing or just on Comixology, because I'm intrigued by this new direction they're going with the character. This new old direction they're going with the character, and so I'm very much going to try it.
One of the cool things in the book, probably my favorite part of the book actually, was getting to see and it happens naturally during the course of the book. Pre-Flashpoint Superman meets the current version of Lana Lang, who obviously doesn't know who he is, but knows that he resembles her Clark. And he's kind of explaining to her what he went through in his timeline. And in the process, the artist, Doug Mankey, the classic Green Lantern artist who drew the last few years of Geoff Johns' Green Lantern, he gets to reinterpret the entire death and return of Superman saga from the 90s. So just a really cool sequence of about 5 or 6 pages of him drawing all these iconic moments from my childhood and probably from his, you know, from his upbringing as well. Really cool to see that. And then at the end, I don't want to spoil it because it's a really cool moment. There's a very, very interesting change to the Fortress of Solitude made at the end that it really, for people that were concerned, that were fans of the New 52 Superman, that were concerned about Rebirth kind of wiping him out and saying he didn't matter, those concerns should go by the wayside because those people definitely got a really cool moment at the end of this issue. So all 4 of these books, really good. I would recommend picking them up. But especially Green Lanterns, Green Arrow, and of course Superman and Batman were good too. But those two were the stars for me. But I would think you would agree, Nick. So far, Rebirth is off to a good start.
3 for 3 in my, or 4 for 4 if you want to count DC Universe Rebirth. Yeah. With at least 2 of those books being what I would term excellent books. That being Green Lanterns and of course the special that we. That we gave it more than its due last week on our special edition.
We basically have already ordered the bronze statue to be built to the issue to commemorate it. So,
hey, and if that's not enough, next week, you know, if 2 straight weeks of Jeff Johns verbal fellatio, as I like to call it, wasn't enough for you, we'll be back again next week with another edition of that as we're reviewing Green Lantern Rebirth, not to be confused with Green Lantern's Rebirth, which we just talked about.
That's right. This is a different, even better Rebirth that we'll be talking about. But yeah. Oh, one minor note about Superman Rebirth that I thought was weird. It's co-written by Peter Tomasi and Patrick Gleason.
Right.
But for some reason, Gleason's name is left off the cover, which I'm assuming is just a printing error at some point. But kind of unfortunate that they did that because when you open it up on the interior, it clearly says written by Peter J. Tomasi and Patrick Gleason. So
is Gleason going to be doing some art on that book going forward, or is he just co-writing?
Yes, my understanding is he will be doing art and co-writing.
So he's going to be alternating art issues with Doug Monkey.
Yep, and I believe that's the case. I'm not sure who the other artist is.
I thought it was Patrick Zercher, or is it Action Comics? Patrick,
Zercher is doing Action. Yeah, okay. The artists on Superman are Patrick Gleason and Doug Monkey. Yeah,
good deal. Sounds good.
All right, so that's what we've been reading, and now let's get into what we've been watching, because currently the number 1, I believe, movie at the box office, number 2 behind Ninja Turtles, I think, movie at the box office right now, X-Men Apocalypse. And when last we spoke to you, our beautiful, wonderful audience, I had seen the movie already, but Mr. Duke had not. Well, that has now been remedied. We've both seen the movie. We both have thoughts on the movie. So, Nick, you saw it. Tell us a little bit about your thought, your spoiler-free thoughts on X-Men Apocalypse.
I liked it overall. I wouldn't say that I loved it. I think it definitely had some issues as it pertains to pacing and character development. But I've seen some reviews that have called it the destruction of the franchise and all these other ridiculous things. And it's not that by any stretch of the imagination. Is it Days of Future Past level? No, not in my opinion. But it's a solid, entertaining movie. That's really, I mean, I walked out of it going, you know, it was just entertaining. I didn't really have any strong, passionate feelings about it, one way or the other. I will say it did a lot for certain characters like Cyclops and Nightcrawler to really, really make me excited to see more of those characters going forward. And especially in the case of Cyclops, that's something I never thought I'd say in a million years.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I can relate. Yeah, I can relate. I liked it more than you did, but I think that that's because, and I know some of my really hardcore X-Men fans will disagree. Like, I know Tim, our friend Tim, has never been a big fan of the series, but for me, this felt like a movie that was made for hardcore X-Men fans, particularly of a certain era, because I completely acknowledge why a lot of mainstream critics might not like this movie. And I completely acknowledge why a lot of casual fans might not like this movie, because there are problems in terms of introducing characters and not explaining who they are or why they're there. For instance, I'll give Psylocke, I'll give Angel, and I'll give Storm as pretty good examples. Storm less so, but Psylocke and Angel being the most prominent examples of characters who are featured heavily in the movie, but you're not entirely sure why they're there or who they are even.
Or what about Jubilee being included only to go on a trip to the mall, essentially?
Right. Yes, yes. Which is a very Jubilee thing to
do. It's a very Jubilee thing to have her do, I'll agree, but like, you have her there and then literally...
I don't think she even spoke a line, did she? Maybe one.
I'm pretty sure she said something at some point about affirming her desire to go to the mall, and then when they were at the mall and having the little tongue-in-cheek discussion about the Star Wars trilogy, I think she got a line in there.
Yeah, that was the one spoiler I'll give is there's a nice little dig at X3 that I won't repeat because I don't want to ruin it for those that haven't seen the movie. Right. But I enjoyed it a lot, though. I mean, because I know who Psylocke is. I know her deal. I know Angel's deal. So I was able to enjoy the movie. And the fan service in this was overwhelming. All the nods to the 80s and 90s X-Men. Jubilee's costume was perfect. Her casting was perfect. Cyclops, the first version of Cyclops that I've ever encountered that I actually kind of related to and liked. And I think because when I was growing up, the portrayal of Cyclops was very much the regimented leader character. And I've been over in some of our columns how I never took to the leader characters, whether it was Leonardo in Ninja Turtles, whether it was Duke in G.I. Joe, whether, you know, all of these leader characters, Captain America and the Avengers, I never took to the leader characters because they always seemed one note to me. Point in a direction, you know, panels of them pointing in directions and shouting, you know, cliches and saying, go do this and go do that. And then,
or in the case of Cyclops, shouting what exactly?
Jean!
There it is. Which we did get one of those in the movie, even though it wasn't by Cyclops. At one point, Xavier screams out Jean, and I was like, yeah, that, a little bit more of that. More of that.
More of that, yeah. But this Cyclops, is they take a very almost X-Men Evolution bent on him, and but better than that show did, in my opinion. They really focused it.
We'll have to do an off the page on that show at some point.
Yes.
That might be like the most opposite you and I have felt about any X-Men project ever.
Yep.
Because I actually kind of like the show.
Yep, and I hated it. but the way that they did that, they almost made it like the early part of Man of Steel when Clark is struggling to discover his powers and he first discovers heat vision. It's a very relatable character that they gave Cyclops, and I really enjoyed him in the movie. I enjoyed Jean in the movie as well. Nightcrawler was great. The action scenes were good for the most part, very good for the most part. And getting to see fan service, like the there's a certain costume that Cyclops wears at the end of the movie that just made me almost squeal with joy in the movie theater. And also a certain I don't want to spoil this for sure, an element of the X-Men universe that hasn't ever really been illustrated on screen in a prominent way.
Right.
So, yeah, I was really excited about all that. Apocalypse was very well done, much better done than you may have heard. A lot of that was overblown. I enjoyed how vague his powers were, which we've talked about before. He just does stuff, and there's no reason for him to do it. But the movie does actually take a step to explain why he can do random things that seemingly make no sense. I enjoyed it. Yeah, it was just a fun X-Men movie. It was not as good as Days of Future Past. I'll acknowledge that. It was not as good as X2. It was not as good as probably The Wolverine. I think it wasn't as good a movie as First Class was, but I think it was a better X-Men movie than First Class was, if that makes sense.
All right, so just for shits and giggles here, let's see, what's there? The first three, right?
Yep.
There's X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Yep.
There's First Class.
Yep.
There's The Wolverine.
Yep.
There's
Days of Future Past.
Days of Future Past, Deadpool, and this. So there's nine, right?
Yep. Ooh, yep.
So if you had to put it somewhere in the nine, where would you put it?
Spitballing here off the top of my head, I would probably put it about five.
Five. Let's see. I'm trying to think of mine. I think for me, the clear-cut top three are some combination of Days of Future Past, X2, and The Wolverine, with Deadpool being like the next notch below. and then there being probably a gap between like Deadpool yeah. and I think I'd have this First Class and the first X-Men movie all hovering about in that same range, and then I'd throw, you know, Origins and X3 down at the far bottom of that list.
I would agree with that. And to be clear to anyone who's having a coronary right now, we like First Class. We just don't love it as much as a lot of people do.
Yeah, for Apocalypse to get bashed for lack of character development and a lack of characters having meaningful directions, I don't understand why First Class didn't get some of that criticism, because there are characters in that movie that have no reason for existing. Like the character of Darwin, who pretty much is only there to be token black guy and then killed off like two scenes later, you know? Yeah. I like First Class, but I do not understand the passionate response it got. I think part of that is just after two straight turds of X-Men movies, we were so pleasantly surprised. We overrated a little bit, but, you know, still a good movie, I would say. Just, I actually would probably say I enjoyed Apocalypse more than I enjoyed First Class.
I thought that the one minor complaint I'll make about Apocalypse related to First Class is I thought First Class did a better job of taking advantage of the time period in terms of, I feel like the 60s made a bigger impact on First Class than the 80s made on Apocalypse in terms of the big set pieces, the big action scenes.
Right. Like. Yeah. Cause outside of some vague references to television and technology, I don't think there was much done with the 80s setting. They made some vague references to superpowers, you know, the idea of the Cold War and stuff, but not as much as, you know, Days of Future Past or First Class played with it. I would agree.
Yes, but entertaining movie. And what do we think is being set up for the future of this one? Because there's a rumor going around that we're going to be having the next movie set in the 90s, which makes sense.
Right.
But also that it may possibly be in space, which after the post-credit scene from Apocalypse, I'm not entirely convinced of the space angle.
Right. We don't want to spoil the post-credit scene for anybody, but I would agree. I don't think space is probably happening. I think the 90s angle, I think that's what they've clearly set up, is a 10-year progression, a roughly 10-year progression between each of these movies. But my concern with that is, at this point, you've cast...
Yeah, I know where you're going.
You've cast actors who are so young. I'm not even talking about the issues you have with the aging of Fassbender and McAvoy and Jennifer Lawrence. That I can get past.
none of whom look 20 years older than they were in the last one.
No. Well,
or 10 years older.
Yeah, than they 20 were. Years older than they were in First Class, which is right. To say. But especially in the case of the kid who played Nightcrawler, if they turn around with another one of these in 3 years, I'm going to have a hard time buying that kid as mid-20s, which is what he would be at that point.
Yeah, he's a great Nightcrawler, but at this point, I wonder if we just have to accept that aging in the X-Men universe doesn't really happen at a normal rate, because even the guy that played Stryker in this one, to me, didn't look 10 years older than he did in the last one.
No, not at all. I would agree. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think they're going to space, but I think the 90s is a natural setting, and I think anybody who's seen the movie and seen the post-credit scene, it's kind of clear who the big bad will be. Now, my question has always been, and it's kind of the same question I have about the Marvel, the MCU, post-Thanos, is once you go to your big, you know, the biggest physical threat you have on your board, how do you make the next villain seem threatening by comparison? Because we just saw, like, the closest to global worldwide destruction that we've seen in any of the X-Men movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you rebuild that conflict with a character or a villain who's probably not going to be able to match Apocalypse in terms of physical threat?
And I think the solution to that has just been seen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, in that you can only go bigger to a certain extent until you become Dragon Ball Z, where you continually say that this villain is more powerful than the last villain to the point where it stretches credibility and you retroactively paint yourself into a corner. I think the answer
is we did hear Xavier say in Apocalypse, he's never felt power like this, which means the logical progression of that would be in the next movie, whenever they come up against the next physical threat, it would not just be power, but it would indeed be power, incredible power.
Incredible power.
Yes.
Ah, Yes, that's all true. I think the solution is to go smaller scale in the threat and make it more personal, kind of like Civil War did with Zemo.
And judging by the post-credit scene, it's certainly easy to envision a scenario such as that.
Yes, yes. And there's plenty of ex-villains that have not been mined yet. Russell Sellers and I were talking about this the other day, who you can also catch here on Place to Be Nation Pop. He and I were talking about all the X-Men villains that have never been featured in a film before. Characters like the Mutates of the Savage Land, the Marauders, the Reavers.
The Morlocks.
The Morlocks, absolutely. The space the space villains that battle against Starjammers.
A version of Juggernaut that actually resembles the Juggernaut from the comics.
Yes, real Juggernaut. These are plenty of there's plenty of them. Mojo, for God's sake.
Oh, yeah, Mojo would be good.
I don't think they'll ever do a Mojo movie, but I would love it. That would just be incredible to me. And you'd have to pick the right comedic actor to play Mojo.
I got it.
Who is it?
You're going to love it.
Oh, I know who you're going to say.
Jonah Hill is Mojo. Think about it. Think about it.
You know what? To be honest, I know you were saying that to troll me.
No, I really wasn't, because
I could see it.
It was based on our Twitter conversation earlier today about how fat Jonah Hill's gotten again. And I've always understood Mojo to be, in terms of the X-Men universe, on par with the Blob in terms of fatness.
Yes, he's a fat upper torso and then metal bottom torso and right. And weird spindly legs. And he's very obnoxious, so right. It would be right up Jonah Hill's
There you go, see?
Alley. No, I would good. That's good casting there. I like it. And then you can introduce Longshot, and you can do all kinds of crazy stuff. But anyhow, I think that pretty well wraps up X-Men Apocalypse. We both think that it's going to stay on Earth next time and probably feature one of the villains we talked about there, or one of the groups of villains we talked about there. And that moves us on to a show that we were a little more critical of in its first episode than a lot of the internet was, and that would be Preacher, which just aired its second episode this week. And let's go ahead and get it out there. Both of us loved
it. Absolutely loved this episode. Could not say, as I texted you while I was watching it, the first 15 minutes of this episode are better than anything they did, or are better than the entirety of the pilot, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree.
The cold opening with the first 5 to 6 minutes of the episode taking place in 1881, and them not giving you any clue what's going on, but it's there for fans of the comics. And I'm hoping that slowly over the course of the season, we're going to get that backstory. And so by the end of the season, when the Saint of Killers is finally let off his leash, it's going to be a big, big oh shit moment, and it's going to set us up for season two in a big, huge way. Once you got past the 1881 stuff, I knew this is a sign of how perfect a cast Joseph Gilgan is as Cassidy. I knew the line was coming at some point. I had a pretty good indication it was coming when I saw what two characters were in the scene. But when he said the line, "Jesus, his face looks like a bloody arsehole," I started laughing uncontrollably. Like, so much so that I missed the next three lines of dialogue. I had to go back and rewind it to hear him following up with the even better line. What happened to him? Shotgun. Well, maybe he shouldn't have missed then. And I was just dying at that point. Like,
it was so good. I had the same experience. I had to rewind it and watch it again, too, because I was laughing so hard at the line. I think that it's become clear at this point that for all the good things about the show, Cassidy is the best.
The best thing. The best thing. As we discussed on our edition of Countdown, he's my favorite character in all of Preacher. And they could not have nailed the essence of that character any more than it appears they have. It's perfect, in my opinion. I wouldn't change a single thing about it.
No, it was so good last night. I honestly thought to myself, just make a Cassidy show at this point. Like, he's so entertaining. But don't get me wrong, I don't want them to do that because he's going to fit perfectly into the what they're doing with the show. But also, for those of you out there, I saw some people saying that the beginning of the episode was slow or they didn't really know what was going. Trust us, it's going somewhere awesome.
Yes. Be patient with it.
I thought they hit the exact tone that they needed to for that segment. the time period was done so well.
And the brutality of that era was got across so well when he walks by the tree of Indians with the scalps, with their, you know, having been scalped. Oh, man. And one thing that you and I have discussed offline, I don't know who this guy that's playing the character is, but it looks like a Steve Dillon drawing just walked off of the page onto the screen. It is eerie in its similarity.
It's almost like, I wonder if he can even act, because they had to have just selected him out of a bunch of headshots and said, that guy looks like a Steve Dillon drawing. Because you're right, it's perfect, right off the page.
Yeah, it's amazing. This one episode did more to sell me on this show being a good adaptation of the comic than any of the interviews, any of the clips, anything in the pilot. I'm fully on board at this point, even if I still have some issues with Tulip, which was the only negative thing I could say about last night's episode. I still think the Tulip we're getting is not a version of Tulip that I recognize. And maybe that's just going to be the conceit of the show, is that we're getting so many of these other characters closely, you know, adapted. Maybe they're just going to take their Tulip in wildly different directions.
And I agree with you, I'm not digging her at all right now, but I think that my biggest problem, other than the accent, is that, to me, from the get-go of Preacher, Tulip was one of the most likable characters, and so far, two episodes in, I don't feel like I have a single reason to actually like her.
Right.
She clearly has no regard for Jesse's own happiness. She's trying to actively ruin whatever he's trying to do in his life for her own gain. She's smarmy and mean to everybody, and not in a Cassidy, aw shucks humor kind of way, but just kind of snarky. They've not done a good job of making me like her. Now, on the flip side of the coin, everybody else, they're doing a bang up job with. Arseface continues to impress me.
Yep.
The guy that's playing him.
And the makeup was actually better last night than it was in the pilot, I thought.
Yep. The one thing that we both would like them to add, and I hope it happens for the end of the season, I want Eugene to get so excited about something that you see the big line of slobber fall out of the arsehole on his face.
Yes. Yes. I agree with that. And then, what about the brief snippet we got of Jackie Earle Haley's Odin Quinn cannon? And it's a scene where he's
so good.
He's buying somebody's property to turn it into an expansion for his meat plant or whatever. And he's talking about all the things that are going to go on there. And he's talking about, you know, the raising of the cattle, the farming of the cattle. And then he stops, and like, if you're a fan of the book, it's almost like you can see in your head what he's seeing in his head, as he pauses and kind of rolls his eyes backwards and says, "The butchering." And like, you just see.
Again, it's going somewhere awesome, people.
Oh man. For all the hesitation I had about the pilot, last night just made me feel so good about the direction the show was going.
I was on a high when that episode ended. I was so happy. I was almost buzzing. I was so happy.
And we haven't even talked about, we both praised the Cassidy fight scene from the pilot, and I think they topped it in last night's episode, honestly.
Amazing. Amazing. It didn't even strike me until the end of the creepy as hell end of the episode that these were the two Angel characters.
From the opening volume of Preacher, yeah.
Right. And amazing fight scene, amazing creepiness to that whole deal. Cassidy, everything involving Cassidy is among the best things ever broadcast on AMC.
It really is. That sounds like hyperbole after two episodes, but Cassidy has been, he's been amazing. I can't say, you know, enough about it. And what about the sub? One thing that we both talked about in the pilot was that it took a little while for Dominic Cooper to start to warm on us, and it took us a little while to really get into him. I thought he was so vastly improved in his performance as Jesse.
Very much so.
From episode one to episode two. So much so that, like, by the end of episode two, I was like, that's Jesse Custer. And I have no issue seeing him as Jesse Custer going forward. Especially that subplot with how he deals with the pedophilic bus driver was so Jesse. Like, where he was trying his best not to get involved, but then realized that he couldn't help himself. Like, just everything about last night's episode, for the most part, just hit in a big, big way for me.
His improvement reminds me, actually, in a weird way, of Stephen Amell on Arrow. Remember when the pilot happened and we were both kind of like, that was pretty good, but we're not so we're not 100% sold on him yet?
I can tell you the moment for me when it happened, the first episode without the voiceover on Arrow.
Yeah.
It's like when it became more about Amell actually having to convey his inner thoughts through emoting rather than relying on the voiceover, that's when the whole show flipped for me.
I totally agree with you on that. And at that point, I remember we both talked about it that week when it happened, and we were like, okay, yeah, he's Oliver Queen now. Like, he gets it now. And I think that was what happened with Dominic Cooper in this second episode. I think, for me, it was a point in this episode where actually, it was at the end of the episode, and I was like, I don't feel like I just watched Dominic Cooper. I felt like I just watched Jess Huster. Because in the first episode, I was still seeing him as Howard Stark, I guess, from Agent Carter. And I was like, you know, I wasn't really seeing him as Jesse. And then at the end of this past episode, I was like, that's Jesse. That's Jesse Custer. My God.
My God, you did it. You beautiful bastard, you did it.
Exactly. So that was very heartening to have a show that we were both very hesitant about a week ago. And it kind of turned us on our heads now, and now we're both in.
And I, as I've discussed offline with you, I hate putting too much stock in the opinions of anybody who works at IGN.com. But in their review of last night's episode, they said that AMC sent them the first five episodes as advanced screeners, and of the five episodes they got, not counting the pilot, so the next four, in their opinion, that last night's was the weakest. Which was not an indictment on their part of last night's episode. They loved it as well, but they're saying if you liked last night's episode, the next three are even better. So we'll see if that's the case or not.
Now, something that has united, for the most part, the comic book community and Preacher, most people are pretty happy with the show, it seems. We're going to go from that to something that has completely divided the comic book community. That, of course, being the recent reveal, and this is the one spoiler type thing we're going to get into on the show tonight. But
well, this isn't really a spoiler when you have Marvel giving the news to USA Today to publish in their newspaper.
Yes, in the recent comic book, Steve Rogers, Captain America number one, by writer Nick Spencer, it was revealed at the end of the issue that. And I'm going to say reveal, but please understand that I'm saying this with the understanding from my end that this is not actually the reveal. This is the conceit of the story, is that Captain America believes that he is an agent of Hydra and has been since he was a small child. So at the end of the issue, he actually murders the character Jack Flagg and turns to the other person in the plane with him and says, "Hail Hydra." So you have that image of Captain America saying, "Hail Hydra." Now, what many of us were surprised by is that this turned into one of the most, probably the most controversial and divisive thing in the comics world since the Killing Joke variant cover from a year ago.
It's stunning to me that in the past month, we got a book that brought Watchmen into some form of current DC mainstream continuity, and yet that's less controversial than this Captain America thing.
Yeah, I mean, there have been think pieces about the Watchmen thing, decrying it and everything, but it hasn't nearly been as universally disliked as I thought it would be by a lot of people. In fact, it's actually been mostly universally embraced.
Right.
To my everlasting surprise, the majority of the comics buying public seems to have embraced the idea of incorporating Watchmen, and is just at each other's throats about this Captain America reveal.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense to me. Okay, anybody who's listening to this show who is even a casual fan of actual comic books, not just the movies and the TV shows, but even if you're a casual reader of comic books, even you probably know there's no way that the story as it's being presented is actually the story. We all know there's some kind of twist or some kind of reveal or something, and it's all going to be explained away, and in 10 issues or fewer, we'll be back to status quo. We all know that. That's the way comics work. So why are we getting so up? I don't understand the hyperbolic reaction to this. Some and people are saying it draws a direct line between Captain America and fascism, or Captain America and Nazism, or Captain America and anti-Semitism, or all these, you know, all these different hateful ideologies based on Captain America's World War II roots. But I would say that, you know, the current version of Hydra is nothing like the Nazi-inspired version of Hydra from the movies or from the comics back in the day. And it's not that. Like, we're 70 years removed from that version of these characters.
Not to mention, and just try to follow along. I promise it'll lead somewhere. Joseph Stalin was the leader of the Soviet Union at one point. Yes. Joseph Stalin, correct me if I'm wrong, killed millions and millions and millions of his own people, correct?
That's my understanding.
Where was this outcry about 10 years ago when Mark Miller wrote the book Superman Red Sun, which positioned Superman as an agent of the Stalin-led USSR? Because I don't remember it if it happened.
I mean, you and I were pretty far removed from from our current day status of being deeply entrenched in the internet comics community. So
that's true.
Hard
that's
to say.
Maybe it was there. You're right. Maybe it was there. But all I'm saying is, this is nothing new. This is the idea of the hero exploring a hero, flipping sides or what have you, is nothing new.
And again, I think he's actually flipped. Like, does anyone actually believe that the idea as it's been presented is actually going to be the idea?
Exactly.
So that, what are we even, like,
it's, people were fine with communist Superman.
It is the closest,
tap, you know,
it's the closest equivalent to the Mark Waid thing from a few months ago, where Mark Waid, when the identity of Zoom was revealed on The Flash, went off on this tirade without ever letting the story play out. You know, there's no need to draw snap reactions. I know the ending of the book was supposed to be shocking, supposed to be controversial, and supposed to get you talking. But honestly, it's people allowing themselves to get worked up over something that will ultimately be nothing.
Let's get real here. I'm going to get real for a few minutes, because it's reminiscent of wrestling fans getting worked by storylines. And for those of you who don't watch wrestling, that basically means people that allow a storyline in 2016 to genuinely
upset them.
Yes. And I'll get further real with you. I hate to even do this, because the whole joy of the story is reading the story. But I'm about 99% sure I know how this is going to go. Not because I've read comics, and here's the quote getting real part, but because I grew up watching soap operas with my mom. And if there's one thing that I learned and I took with me from those years of watching soap operas, specifically Days of Our Lives, it's that the answer is always, always implanted memories. That is always the answer to every long-form story.
Or what about a swift bump to the head? Or even better, a case of electrocution that leads from Hydra cap to Tourette's cap.
Tourette's cap. Oddly connecting gold dust to Captain America. I like that.
Yes.
But it's always in play. The idea that Captain America has been a Hydra agent his entire life is inherently stupid. And the person that wrote it knows that, because the idea of it is, you're supposed to know this is inherently not possible, because Cap has stopped Hydra's plans for 70 freaking years. Are they going to be like, well, that was part of our long-form game, is for you to stop us for 70 years and then reveal that you're a quintuple agent or whatever the hell? Now, it's so inherently stupid, people. Like, it's clearly an implanted memory in Cap's subconscious to make him think that he's grown up and to change his personality type. And just imagine what's going to happen when he finds out that they've manipulated him in this way, that they violated him in this way. He's going to be pissed, and it's going to add a new layer to an age-old, tired Cap versus Hydra storyline that's been beaten into the ground over the course of 70 years, you're going to have a new layer there that Cap is going to have a new reason to be upset with them other than just they're bad guys. Now it's going to be personal between them. And I listen, is it the best storyline in the world? Probably not. Is it even a good comic? I don't know. I haven't read the whole comic.
I haven't read the number one issue. I've read a few pages, and I also read the Free Comic Book Day, and I've loved all the pages I've read of Nick Spencer's Captain America thus far. So
it's just we have seen it done with other characters in other situations, and I just don't feel like
Captain. We just had a book, a 26 issue weekly title, Batman and Robin Eternal, that just wrapped up not too long ago, where in the first issue you are shown Batman murdering somebody with a gun, and you are led to believe for 25 issues that he killed somebody with a gun. Did any of us ever think at any point in that story that Batman actually shot somebody with a gun and killed them? No.
No, and you weren't supposed to.
I mean,
nobody writes a story, and they do that because they know how people are going to react if they actually did do that. So, you know, it's like, but you're not even giving them the chance to not do it. it's crazy. I mean, we just got done, or we're actually still going on now, on what, 5 years now of a comic book based on a video game, which we will get to later, where Superman punches a hole through the Joker and murders him. And then becomes evil and becomes a dictator of the world. But that's not a bridge too far. Captain America being manipulated by Hydra.
I think the difference there, and with the Red Sun comparison, is that
they're alternate universes.
They're alternate universes, and
sure, but there's not like there's never been a mind controlled. There was a mind controlled Superman story as part of Infinite Crisis, if you recall, where because of the influence,
there was a mind controlled Superman as part of Hush.
Yes, where and both of which had him striking women in the course of the story. So you know, I mean. Not that I have a problem with that in the confines of the story, because there's superheroic women who are fighting him. But it's just people need, in my opinion, and I'm not one to tell people when they should or shouldn't be offended by. Everybody's got different things that set them off. But calm down and let's stop living in a culture that wants to rush to judgment about everything. That's all I'm saying. And I say that as somewhat of a hypocrite, because we give our thoughts every week on stuff. But I think in general, we've both matured enough over the years to know that sometimes you just there's a difference between criticizing a story for the story. Now, if you think that this is a cheap story or whatever, hey, that's your opinion. Criticize the storytelling. But if the content itself, if you're not allowing that to play out and you're getting yourself sucked in, and not looking at the totality of it, I think you're doing yourself a disservice. And it's, frankly, making things tough for creators in the social media age to tell their stories. Because I got to be honest, I would not want to work for Marvel or DC right now as a creator, as a writer anyway, because, or even as an artist, because it feels like no matter what you can do, there's going to be a large swath of people who are not just upset about it, but upset to the point of death threats and all manner of just insanity. So, I mean, to me, while writing DC or Marvel comics should be the most fun job in the world, it feels like at times it isn't because of the fan base.
What will really suck is if these death threats thing wind up turning, like in true comic book villain fashion, wind up turning Nick Spencer into the next Dan Slott. And Lord knows we got enough Dan Slotts running around the world. We don't need another one.
Yeah, I would agree. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. We've pretty well covered the Captain America issue. I know it's controversial, and we'll probably get some people upset with some of the things we said. Let us know on Place to Be Nation Comics on the Facebook page.
Right.
Hit us up and tell us your thoughts. But one thing that I don't think we're going to get any hate on or any disagreement on is the tragedy that took place last month with the loss of one of the great modern comic artists and writers,
right,
in Darwin Cook, responsible for DC's New Frontier, responsible for The Shade, issues of Starman, just a litany.
Catwoman
with Ed Brubaker, and on his own.
before Watchmen, which all of a sudden is newly relevant all over again.
Yes, before Watchmen, which he worked on Silk Spectre, and he did the brilliant Minutemen.
It was amazing.
Book. One of the best, certainly one of the best of our era. I think one of the best of any era. He was a throwback in many ways to the days of Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and people like that. But he lent, even though he often drew nostalgic books, he lent a sense of modernism to them, particularly in his writing, that had this, yes, it might take place in the 50s or it might take place in the 40s, but it was with a modern sensibility and it was told in a way that adults could enjoy, but a kid would also be able to pick up. So I think one of the best of all time. I loved so much of his work, especially New Frontier, but also his variant covers, his work on the Shade miniseries, his work on All-Star Western, just phenomenal, phenomenal creator.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It always sucks when you lose people that, you know, even though you never knew them personally, you felt like you had a connection to them. That New Frontier book and the animated movie, you know, were kind of my gateway into Silver Age concepts, you know, because I grew up reading comics in a post-2000, you know, setting. I really didn't have that context, and he kind of was the one that made me interested in the Silver Age at all. So, you know, people who are far more eloquent than you or I have said so many great things about him, but, you know, his work, it stands on its own merits, and it will stand the test of time. There is no question in my mind. It was both of its time yet timeless. It just happened so quickly. I don't think any of us were prepared for it. And I, you know, we're not his family. I can only imagine what they're going through right now. And, you know, they're in all of our thoughts. Even still, you know, a month after his passing. And so if you've never read any of Darwin Cook's work, I'd go out and pick up the New Frontier. And if you can't get your hands on a physical copy of the New Frontier, go to Netflix and find the animated movie, because it's a pretty good adaptation of that story, in my opinion. So there, go see what all the hype's about, and then you know, stop and pause and reflect on what we lost.
And he also, I've neglected to mention, he also worked a lot on Batman the Animated Series, a little bit on Justice League, and heavily on Batman Beyond, doing storyboarding, doing animation for them. So he hit us in that realm as well. And again, like Nick said, New Frontier, check it out. You won't regret it. Also, because of New Frontier and also some of his other work, one of the most underrated, excellent Green Lantern writers / artists of all time.
Right. Absolutely. Because New Frontier is kind of framed from the perspective of Hal Jordan. So.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons I think both of us were drawn to it.
Love it so much. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, moving on to lighter subjects, there was also a big announcement recently. Marvel Unlimited has really changed the game for digital comics. It's a great service that we've pimped on here numerous times. And it truly is everything that we've been led to believe it was by people like Ben Morris, people like Todd Weber, and people like Nick Duke. I've been experimenting with it myself, and it's excellent. I mean, it's an incredible service. And as a result of the success of Marvel Unlimited, there was recently the announcement of Comixology Unlimited. Now, Comixology is a digital comics website, arguably the premier one.
Well, now owned by Amazon.
Yeah, and where you can go and buy single-issue comics
or trades
or whatever through them. And this will now basically digitize that and put it in a Netflix style for comics,
with some limitations. So
now let's talk about the details of this deal.
Okay, so compared to Marvel Unlimited, which is if you go with the Marvel Unlimited monthly subscription, is a $9.99 price point. They're going with a lower price point, $6.99 a month, 30-day free trial if you want to sign up. But the catch is, rather than going for the Marvel approach of Marvel throwing stuff up there and kind of leaving it there and giving you entire runs of titles, Comixology Unlimited is intended to cycle books on and off, first of all, but also probably only give you – they've used Walking Dead as an example. They're probably only going to throw up the first three or four volumes of Walking Dead in an effort to hook you and entice you to buy the other trades full price through Comixology or go to your shop and pick them up. So this is going to be a great way for you to try out a lot of books, especially books from third-party publishers or indie publishers, you know, non-Big Two, so to speak. A lot of Image, a lot of Dark Horse,
a lot of IDW.
Those kind of companies are going to be heavily involved in here. So if you've ever been interested in indie comics, for lack of a better term, this is a great way to check them out. The major drawback, as it continues to be in the all-you-can-read digital space, is that DC is not partnering with Comixology on this. DC will have no titles listed as part of this, to my understanding anyway. And it just becomes increasingly frustrated as someone who tends to lean DC, you know, that that we're not getting a DC Unlimited, you know, some version of that. I think I really, really wish it was something that DC seemed interested in doing, but there doesn't seem to be any movement towards that, and that's frustrating.
I think that one thing, even though we both lean DC, I think in our preferences, I guess you would say, in terms of characters or whatnot, or stories historically or whatnot, I think that there's definitely truth to the idea that DC lags behind in terms of decision making, probably as a result of Warner Brothers owning them. Marvel has set the bar for so many different things over the years, and I think that we've seen it with something like trade collections. For years, DC's trade collections suffered, especially around the time, right before the New 52 started, the few years before that, and then into the first year or two of the New 52, the trade releases, we would always lament how long it would take them to come out. Well, now, as
trade
a result,
waiting wasn't an option. Really, yeah, I mean, realistically, really for about 5 years for DC, because you were going to be spoiled, or you were going to be so hopelessly behind by the time the trade ever came out, it just wasn't realistic.
That's why I stopped trade waiting on Scott Snyder's Batman, and that's why I stopped reading several of the ancillary Green Lantern titles, because I couldn't afford to buy them single issues, and I wasn't comfortable you know, waiting for the trade because people spoil me on Twitter. So it's really frustrating from that standpoint. And so finally, now we're starting to see DC kick it up a notch with their trade releases. They're finally getting their trade releases out in a good order. They're also finally doing what Marvel was doing 10 years ago and republishing all of these classic stories. We're seeing Mike Grell's Green Arrow, and we're seeing John Byrne's Man of Steel, which they've been doing for a few years now in the collections. We're seeing Mark Waid's Flash finally get collected. We're seeing all these classic runs finally get collected. My point being, probably in 5 years, DC will probably decide to do an Unlimited service, because that's usually the trend with them, is they wait 4 or 5 years after it becomes hot to actually do it. So, and the same thing with their Absolute. They finally started printing their omnibuses or omnibuy in a better manner and binding them better, because Marvel's bindings were so good. So I'm hoping that will be the case here, and they'll eventually jump on. There's no reason for DC not to do it if it has been successful for Marvel. And in fairness, we're both just assuming this has been a successful thing for Marvel based on how good it is, but there's a possibility that it's actually cost them money. I don't know.
I don't know either, but I have a hard time seeing that.
Yeah,
because you're able, it enables you to monetize titles that are out of print, which if they're out of print, they're just sitting there. You know what I mean? Like it enables you to monetize things in ways that you weren't able to do before.
Well, with all that said, we've got one more topic to hit before our break. And that is a little tease of a sequel to a video game that came out a few years ago that we both enjoyed quite a bit. There was a game that came out several years ago now that set the stage for a very successful, one of the most successful adaptation comics that DC has done, called Injustice, Gods Among Us. And this was a fighting game in the style of Mortal Kombat by the Mortal Kombat studio, NetherRealm. And very violent, very brutal, mature-rated game that was an alternate take on the DC Universe that we referenced earlier, in which Superman has gone power mad, basically, because of something that the Joker did, which he murdered or forced, actually, oh, I forgot, he forced Superman to murder Lois and the baby that they had, the unborn baby they had. So this caused Superman, understandably, to go nuts, and now he's a dictator of sorts, and that puts him at odds with much of the superhero community. Anyway, now it looks like we're going to be getting a sequel, finally, to that game. Nick, what are your thoughts, and what kind
Overwatch,
of information do you have?
Soldiers, science.
I'm very excited, obviously. I think, you know, it's long overdue. I think the game was so well received, not just by comic book fans, but by video game fans in general. Played great, had a great roster of characters. My ultimate wet dream is that they do what they did with Mortal Kombat and just explode the roster going forward, and we get, you know, a massive roster of dig deep into the DC universe and just give us, you know, damn it, I want Ambush Bug. I want, you know, I want Black Manta. I want God knows who else. I just want a cavalcade of obscure DC characters that I can play as. But anybody who played Injustice, I don't think you can see this rumor and this the current rumors that they're prepping to announce it officially at E3, which is coming up in a couple weeks. So,
and one thing that I do hope that is that they take what they did with the story mode in the first one, which was easily the best story mode of any fighting game I've ever played, in terms of the way that it integrated into the gameplay naturally and forced you to play as all these different characters, told a beautiful animated movie, essentially. It would have been perfect in the DC animated universe. I hope that they take that and they expand it, because my one criticism about Injustice was that the story mode was too short. That it was, you know, it ended pretty quickly in terms of it didn't take it too long to beat it. So I'm hoping that they expand that and make it even longer with a bigger cast of characters. And it's exciting. It's really exciting. Fighting games aren't my preferred genre of video games, but I did enjoy this one a hell of a lot. And I'm really hoping that they expand it, make it bigger and better than ever. And my only concern is, did they wait too long to do the sequel? Because that is an issue sometimes. But in video games, it's not as big an issue as it is in other forms of media. So I'm really looking forward to it. I'm also hoping that we're getting other types of DC games developed that are less of the fighting genre. But we'll that all remains to be seen, except for one.
Yeah, exactly. The one you and I are beyond excited about it. I still can't believe it's actually happening, and I can't believe now it would seem we're only a couple of weeks away, you know, from the release.
Tell them, Nick.
If you weren't impressed by our 35-minute discussion of a 4-year-old Telltale video game when we did The Walking Dead a while back, hey, man, get excited, because in the coming weeks we're going to be bringing you some Telltale Batman, because Telltale announced that game is not only complete, but it is coming this summer, which would be, I would assume, sometime in that magical period known as June, July.
Big pop that literally 4 people listening to this podcast will get.
So,
oh my God.
Sometime in that time frame, I would think we're going to have a Telltale Batman game on our hands. And I cannot wait. I don't even know anything about it other than they said you're going to be able to play as both Bruce and Batman. So sign me up.
So,
and by sign me up, I mean it'll take me 8 months to play it like it did The Walking Dead.
Yeah, really. I'm going to be on that like white on rice, man. I am so, so excited for this game. Love The Walking Dead series. Love the demo that I played of A Wolf Among Us, also by Telltale. And just their style of game is very interesting. Obviously inspired by the PlayStation 3 classic Heavy Rain, in that it's almost an interactive movie of sorts. But I just love it. I think it's wonderful. It's a great way to do a Batman game. It's going to stand in contrast, because you're not going to be able to top the Arkham games if you're trying to do an action-based Batman game.
Right.
Don't even try it.
Nope.
They're going a completely different direction, and they're focusing on Batman's mind and your decision-making ability as a player, I'm assuming anyway.
Yes.
Love it. Absolutely love it. And apparently they're working on a Marvel game too, correct?
Yes, they are working on a Marvel game. That one I don't know much of anything about, But that working on that, and then apparently this fall we're getting Walking Dead season 3 as well. So,
oh, excellent! Can't wait. I just hope that the Marvel game doesn't force you to play as Mr. Fantastic. Other than that, I'm good.
Well, then you can play Mr. Fantastic however you want to play him, ranging from kind of a aloof dick to a lot of an aloof dick.
That's right. To really, really boring. So, I can just see him being the guy that just people ask him rhetorical questions and he answers and then doesn't understand why people find that annoying.
That's good.
But yeah, so anyway, that puts us up to our break, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you've enjoyed the first half. We've been pretty heavy on comics talk in this first half. Also some Preachers, some X-Men Apocalypse. When we come back, we're going to hit you up with all the movie and TV rumors that we've managed to gather up and news items to talk about. So we got some pretty cool stuff about the DC Extended Universe, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the Marvel Television Universe, the DC Television Universe, and a little bit of just a hodgepodge of things from there. So stick with us, listen to the ads for some of these awesome podcasts, and come back on the other side of the break.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
That was too much.
No, it was better than your Australian accent. Or no. Your New Zealand accent.
No. You're giving that a bad name. That was one of my finest moments in life, I feel. Truly an accomplishment worthy of celebration. You need to bring it back for this last half of the episode?
Oh dear.
Let's get things started. A little bit of movie news for you. You may have heard, and we're stepping on a few podcast toes here that have already talked about it, but Jeff Johns, the wonderful writer of such gems as Green Lantern Rebirth, Flash Rebirth, and DC Universe Rebirth, as well as
the best runs on the characters of Green Lantern and Aquaman in the character history.
Yes. Has moved on for the time being from the comic book publishing world into the world of film to take a more active, hands-on role in the DC Extended Universe, a.k.a. the DC Movie Universe. He's already had a heavy hand in all the TV adaptations you've seen, from Constantine to Arrow to The Flash especially, and to Supergirl as well. But he's about to be running in the big time with big-budget movies, along with a co-pilot, I guess you would say, from the WB side, who's more of a movie executive type.
Yeah. So the implication that we've been led to believe is that Johns will kind of be the creative force behind these movies, and John Berg will kind of be heading up the financial production side of it. So
yes, that's to clear up a misunderstanding from Todd's podcast last week. John Berg, not John Byrne. Totally different. We don't want John Byrne running the movie studio necessarily, although he's a great creator in his own right. But I'm really excited about this. I know a lot of people think that people are overreacting to this. I think there is a little bit of an overreaction element to it. But I do think that I have a lot more faith in Jeff Johns from a creative standpoint to understand these characters and the heart of these characters.
Exactly.
Than I do of Zack Snyder, who I feel like is married to specific versions of these characters.
Exactly. Ultimately, you know, what Kevin Feige does over at Marvel is he's in charge of making sure that these characters are being, you know, treated with respect and for breaking story, essentially. And then the filmmakers go off and make the movies. Now, granted, Marvel has a certain formula they have to follow that Warner Brothers does not necessarily want to get as, you know, formulaic an approach.
Right.
But you still need somebody who is overseeing the overall story you're trying to tell in an interconnected universe and also making sure that these characters are being, you know, adapted in ways that retain the essence of what makes them popular in the first place. And if you're talking about capturing the essence of characters, there is no better choice on the face of God's green earth than Jeff Johns.
Nobody does it better. Basically, to put it in comics terms, these movie frames, if you're trying to build a connected film universe, you have to have an editor-in-chief, put it in comics terms. Like something like Jim Shooter was for Marvel in the 70s and 80s in particular.
Right.
Someone like
Paul Levitz.
Yeah, you've got to have that person that can make sure that you can make your own separate movies. Don't be like Marvel. They don't need to be exactly like Marvel and make everything feel the same. But you have to have movies and characters that can interact with each other in an interesting way and that can be different from one another but share an overall universe. The way that in the comic books, I mentioned this, I believe, recently, that you could read Kevin Smith's Green Arrow in the early 2000s, but then which has one tone, and then you can go and you can pick up Jeff Johns' JSA, which has a different tone, or then you could go and pick up the Brubaker and Rucka Batman or Gotham Central, which had a totally different tone.
And yet they never feel completely out of step.
No, you accept that they share the universe together, even though they have different feels to them, different styles to them, and I think that can work on the big screen. You just have to make sure that when they come together, it's a true coming together, and it's not one style dominating the others. And I feel like that's what we're going to get, hopefully, going through. I'm being very optimistic because to me, Suicide Squad and Wonder Woman look totally different to me from the preview footage that we've seen, but they also both look like they could inhabit the same universe.
Right. And my question, I guess, with this is how long is it really going to be before we start to see Johns put his stamp on things? Because Wonder Woman's already in principal photography. Suicide Squad, obviously, is wrapped in principal photography. Justice League is in principal photography. Aquaman is pretty heavily into pre-production at this point. James Wan's been talking about working on that pretty hard. So how soon? I mean, it may take some time to judge what kind of work Jeff Johns is doing, because it may be 2-3 years down the road before we really see his thumbprint on things. So I would say to everybody, from both a positive aspect and a negative aspect, whether you're looking forward to Jeff Johns being in charge or not looking forward to it, let's all just wait a little bit and not be in such a rush to judge, you know,
Yeah, we don't know what scripts are completely finished yet. We don't know what Aquaman's script is, if it's completely finished yet. But potentially, you know, it could tie into this next movie that we're going to discuss, which is The Flash, which is a movie that has a director finally attached to it.
A new director. You know, we covered on our last rundown that director Seth Graham Smith had dropped out of directing the pictures. He was set to make his big screen debut with that. And so it would seem like one of Jeff Johns' first real decisions he probably had a say in was the hiring of a guy who I am going to butcher this name, Rick Famuyiwa. And he's primarily known for a movie called Dope that came out in 2015 about a geeky teenager growing up in a crime-ridden Los Angeles neighborhood. I've not seen the movie. I have talked to a couple people who have seen the movie, and I've heard you know, very, very positive reaction to that. He's also directed a movie which I have seen, surprisingly enough, that you, I think you're going to be surprised I watched this. So a couple months ago, I was in a hotel room, and I can't remember what I was doing in a hotel room or where I was, but I watched Confirmation, the HBO movie about the Clarence Thomas's 1991 Supreme Court nomination hearings, where basically the entire movie takes place during Anita Hill's testimony. And it's actually really good. It was really
I'm sure it is, but talk about movies I would not expect Nick Duke to have watched.
It was really interesting, man. I can kind of get into the courtroom drama thing sometimes. It kind of played a little bit like that. So,
well, cool. So what you're telling me is thumbs up for this hire, in your opinion?
I would say so, based on the one thing of his I've seen, although that didn't have any action in it whatsoever, unless you count Kerry Washington talking about pubic hair on Coke cans. That's kind of actiony, I would say. But other than that, not much.
It's an actionable offense. Yes, I haven't seen Dope either. I heard similarly good things about it. I do want to check it out at some point. But it's interesting. It's also a good move for the DC Extended Universe to hire a director of color, which will probably, if I'm not mistaken, he'll be only the second person after Ryan Coogler, who is an African American, to have directed a superhero movie.
Well, James Wan, Asian American though, and he's getting
getting
Aquaman. You know, remember Patty Jenkins has Wonder Woman as a woman. So I mean, that's right there. It seems like DC has kind of got some good diversity in their directorial ranks.
Yeah, and hopefully they can keep away from too much editorial interference and just have and that's what I think. You're right. They need to. Let's pump the brakes on the Jeff thing. It probably won't be there for a while, because I hope that most of the editorial oversight will be in the story stages, in the story planning stages, as opposed to once the movie's in production.
Right.
That's where the studios sometimes step in and
tend to overreact a bit.
Yes, tend to overreact a bit, which sets us up nicely for our next item, which is the upcoming, highly anticipated film, Suicide Squad, opening in August. And I'm going to be there opening weekend. You're going to be there opening weekend.
I think we'll be there together, actually.
I think we'll be there together on opening weekend.
Aw.
It's just so cute. I love it. But we're all going to be there. Everybody's excited about this, it seems. It looks like it's going to be a really good movie, but who knows? It may suck. We don't know yet. But some people think they know it's not going to suck. Some people think they know it's going to be an overwhelming success, and those people would seemingly be, according to the rumor mill, according to the grapevine, Warner Brothers executives. Tell them, Hawk.
Well, you and I talked about a while back how we both kind of share frustration with Warner Brothers in that they tend to overreact to test screenings. And let's give them some examples of that. As we mentioned a few shows back in 2008. Or 2008, as we were preparing for the release of Green Lantern in 2009. Is that accurate? No, wait a minute.
No, 2010
into 2011. I know that didn't sound right. Anyway, apparently Green Lantern was test screening very well. Warner Brothers was so confident in the movie that they were paying sequels, a franchise, and an entire universe, you know, spawning out of the Ryan Reynolds Green Lantern film. As we all know, things didn't exactly turn out that way. Flash forward a few years to, you know, late last year, we were getting reports that Batman vs. Superman was receiving standing ovations at test screenings. And not even a month later, there were reports that the studio was overwhelmingly concerned about the reaction the film was getting at test screenings. So, in my mind, if these test screenings are actually happening, it sounds like Warner Brothers is taking individual screenings and basing their entire, like, outlook on these movies on these screenings.
It reminds me, it makes it sound as if Warner Brothers is run by Vince McMahon.
Yes, in that when one crowd does something to a wrestler he doesn't really care about, he then changes that wrestler's entire future. If the wrestler he does care about, then he ignores every crowd for months on end. But we're getting off topic. Flash forward to the past couple of months, and reports have started to leak out that Suicide Squad has been actively test screening for a couple of weeks now in California. Various audiences who don't know what they're going to get to screen when they sit down to watch the movie, and it's just a random audience that they're testing in front of. Based on those test screenings, Warner Brothers is apparently supremely confident in Suicide Squad being a massive hit. So much so that we have already heard rumors about not just a Suicide Squad sequel being fast-tracked for a potential 2018 release, but also the following films. And again, this is all rumor, so we've reached, once again, our good buddy Russell Sellers' favorite part of the show each and every week, where we delve into mostly baseless rumor. So those rumors would have you believe that we're not just getting a Suicide Squad sequel, but also a Harley Quinn / Birds of Prey movie, and also a Joker standalone movie, and also, in quite possibly the most bizarre superhero movie rumor since Aunt May as a 60s secret agent, a Captain Boomerang standalone movie.
Good eye, Mike.
Do you buy any of this?
Well, if it's going to be Captain Boomerang,
God, here we go.
Perhaps it'd be a chance for old Greg.
You're
going to
be sad and disappointed when Jai Courtney doesn't do the Australian accent in that movie, by the way.
He better do it. If he doesn't do it, I'm going to find him, and I'm going to make him understand me set of skills. Now I'm switching into an Irish accent randomly. Anyway, man, it's hard to get out once you're in. Okay, a Harley Quinn and Birds of Prey movie.
That could actually happen. That makes some sense.
That makes sense to me, especially if Harley is the breakout character success that a lot of people think she's going to be in this movie.
And
she's
you can have the Joker in that one and have him in conflict with the Birds of Prey and do a different version of the encounter between he and Barbara that would make a lot of people a little bit happier if it turned out a different way, and also have possibly a big moment at the end where Harley turns her back on the Joker once and for all and sets off on her own path. That movie makes a lot of sense. That's one you can envision easily.
Now, a Captain Boomerang movie? No, not as a standalone. Now, if they did a Rogues movie of the Flash's Rogues and had him
without the Flash in it,
I could buy that actually, because you can do it almost as a Thunderbolts type fake hero.
Right, but in theory, wouldn't Suicide Squad already be that?
Yeah, well, a little bit different, because the way that I would see it would be the Rogues kind of pretending to be actual good guys. The Suicide Squad know they're bad guys, and they're forced into doing this.
Okay.
This would be them willingly do it. But again, I don't think that's ever going to happen. I think that's a completely fake rumor. BS. Now, the rumor that I think is probably something that they're considering that is the worst idea imaginable is a Joker standalone movie. Talk about a misunderstanding of a character. The Joker, especially the Joker they're going with, you cannot have a movie about the ultimate villain. It'd be like doing a Satan movie. you can't do that. If he's the Joker that he appears to be, where he tortures people and is the ultimate evil, abusive, horrendous. Because the difference between the Joker and every other villain, the Joker has zero redeeming qualities. There's nothing good about him. Nothing. Absolutely.
To be fair, though, I think from a film perspective, the redeeming quality is he's somebody you love to hate and you are enthralled by, even though you aren't necessarily empathetic with him or don't necessarily want to see him do well, if that makes sense.
A film has to have a protagonist.
Would agree, yes.
Protagonist of a compelling story.
I agree.
Yeah, so anyway, that's the one that I kind of believe that they probably would consider, but would be a mistake, and I would hope that Geoff Johns or somebody would step in and say, look, there's a better way to go about this. Let's integrate him in a different movie in a different
way.
Plus,
you got to figure he's at least going to play some kind of role in that Ben Affleck standalone Batman movie.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and you could – yeah, exactly. And you could do – there's a lot of villains. If you want to do the villain as the hero movie, there's a lot of characters you can do that with besides
– plus, there's a lot of room for that character to show up. Like I said, he could show up in a Birds of Prey movie quite easily. If you expand the universe enough, I mean, it'd be kind of cool to see him possibly in a Nightwing movie. You could do him with the Legion of Doom or the Injustice Society in a Justice League sequel. I mean,
don't get me sexually frustrated by talking about the possibility of a Nightwing movie, Nick. That just, now you're just playing with me.
Well, that's what it's going to be. That Channing Tatum rumor is going to turn out to be Nightwing, and you and Russell are just going to go fap all over the place.
I don't know about him as Nightwing. I'll say that. I don't have any issues with the guy.
But if I have issues with him playing Hal Jordan, that's the worst thing that could ever happen.
It is. It is. You're biased. You're biased against him. The way that you used to be biased against one Matthew McConaughey.
That's true.
Who is now one of the finest actors in all of Hollywood.
So are you officially predicting that in 5 years, Channing Tatum will be one of the finest actors in all of Hollywood?
I'm predicting that if True Detective ever gets a season 5, Channing Tatum will be on it. One day in the distant future. That's right, season 5. I'm skipping all the way season 5.
Let us not forget that not even True Detective could redeem Taylor Kitsch, so let's not get our hopes up there.
Yeah, and we're probably not ever going to get even a third season of True Detective.
That's true. So, but we have anyway, veered. We have veered.
We've veered.
Took a hard left.
Let's get it back down to the television level. We talked about movies. We talked about DC movies in particular. Let's get to the DC television side, where we're a little show called Supergirl that debuted this past fall on CBS.
Which I still haven't seen the last, 17 episodes of.
And I watched all the episodes, and it had its ups and downs, and unfortunately had very, very poor ratings.
But I mostly liked what I saw. My DVR didn't record the Red Tornado episode, so the last episode I've seen was the episode before the Red Tornado episode, which I know was, episode 6, I think, something like
that. Yeah, a lot to like about this show, a little bit to dislike too, but the most important thing is the thing that the show got right, which is that the lead character is the best character. Supergirl is the best character on the show.
Right.
She's incredible. Melissa Benoist, or Ben, I dare not call her Benoist, but that's, again, we're getting off topic there. But
Are you saying that Crypto is in the yard?
In the enclosed pool area. Anyhow, we apologize for that reference.
That's a Ric Flair oh, God.
Yes, but Melissa Benoist, she's excellent as Supergirl. And anyway, people were concerned about the future of the show because it appeared that it wasn't going to get renewed at CBS. And thankfully, CW stepped in, and Supergirl will officially move to the CW in the fall.
Which is where it should have been from the get-go.
Agreed. It never was a good fit for
the
CW.
The tone of the show, the setting of the writing of the show, the way the show was shot, it never felt like a CBS show. It felt like a CW show with a much bigger budget. And yes, they're going to have to do some budget cuts. I understand that. That could wind up being a negative thing, but I think it's going to find its audience on CW. I think it's going to make a lot more sense being paired with Flash, Arrow, and Legends Tomorrow. And hopefully there'll be a storyline reason to bring her onto that Earth in the Flarrow, the Flash and Arrowverse.
And I think that, Wes, that's what we're both hoping for. I think we're both hoping for whether it's what we think, what I think, which will be some sort of a crisis event that will combine the Earths, or whether it's just some sort of a some sort of other way to merge the multiverse together in some way. I hope that there is a really – because think about the possibilities now. You're going to have a 4-part crossover between these 4 shows. You got to have a cool story.
That's how you do it.
To combine them.
That's how you do it, Greg. A 4-night, 4-hour crisis.
Yep, I agree. I agree.
And make that each show's mid-season finale.
Yep.
Instead of doing it the week before. Do it that way. That's how I would do it. But we'll see if that actually happens.
And I'm really excited. And I'm excited to see, yes, the budget's going to be lower. But
hey, Calista Flockhart's leaving, so that's good.
Yes, Calista Flockhart is leaving, and I thought she was one of the weakest parts of the show. I hated the Cat Grant character. And at the beginning, that was the point, but they try to make you empathize with her as the season goes on, and I never did.
Right.
Because, I'm sorry, I get it. You have a rough exterior and a heart of gold, but there's still no reason to treat everyone around you like crap, which she does throughout the whole season.
Right.
So, glad she's gone. I think that's a weight off the show. And I also, obviously, I've been outspoken at times on Twitter about my dislike of the entirety of the James, not Jimmy, James Olsen character. And I hope that they fix that on the CW as well. But Kara is great. Her supporting cast around her, the guy they've got playing Martian Manhunter on the show is really good.
Right.
He's one of the strong points of the show. So I'm excited about this. I think it's great. I especially love, for those that didn't see the crossover episode between Supergirl and Flash.
That would include me.
They have great chemistry. Like that, the casts have great chemistry together. Well, it's mainly Flash interacting with Supergirl's cast, but it was just really fun. I'm looking forward to how it integrates into the Flareoverse. And I think it's going to be a good thing. I think it's ultimately going to be for the best of both Supergirl and for the CW DC universe.
I totally agree. But one interesting thing that makes me wonder if they might not be integrating the Earths is apparently they're introducing Superman in the first couple of episodes of season Supergirl. Going to actually have the character of Superman on there. Which actually, maybe that on the flip side, maybe that would be all the more reason to do the crisis so that you could just move Supergirl over and then, you know, you don't have to worry about finding a way to integrate Superman as well.
That's a great we speculated about this on a phone conversation maybe last week or the week before, back when it was first announced that Supergirl was changing networks. And you were saying, how can they integrate it when, you know, you can't – at that time, we were assuming they couldn't use Superman. And I said immediately, oh, I know exactly how you do it. You do a crisis – and you basically put Supergirl in the, and I'm pushing my spectacles up my nose right now, the 1985 Crisis on Infinite Earths Power Girl role, where she's one of the leftovers from the previous multiverse. So in other words, her universe and our universe are merged together, and she makes it over, but not everyone from her supporting cast makes it over. And basically it strands her on Earth Prime, and now she's the last survivor of two worlds. She's now lost Krypton, and she's lost her entire Earth.
But then you would have to pretty much rebuild your entire cast. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like I think it's more likely that it's her and a handful of others.
I don't think that they'll do the entire cast.
Unfortunately, James Olsen is probably safe.
Probably. That is an unfortunate thing. But yeah, probably her supporting cast will make it over. But I think without Superman, and I think that they might even move all of National City over somehow. Maybe do a Brainiac storyline or something like that.
Oh,
but
yeah, that'd be cool.
I definitely think that they leave Kal-El behind, so she's lost two homeworlds basically. And I think it would be a great angle, and it would make her a more potent character when you're not going to have Clark there to come in and save her when she needs saving or whatever.
All right, here's my question.
Yeah.
Given the casting of The Flash, where they showed a willingness to go back to previous incarnations and reach back into that pool, do you think there's a chance that the fan theory, the fan dream of Tom Welling finally in the suit actually happens?
Oh my gosh. I didn't even think about that until you just mentioned it. I hope it happens, particularly because I don't know if he would be willing to come back and do a full series again, because he talked about how burnout he got doing Smallville for 10 years. But particularly if Superman's popping up in two or three episodes and then not, except maybe in dream sequences or something, that would be ideal for me. I think that would be awesome. It would be a great callback. It would be a great sort of, like you said, reaching back into history the way the Flash did with John Wesley's ship. And
they can't really get – I mean, Dean Cain already plays a different character on the show.
Your character, yep.
I'm assuming Brandon Routh is not going to be playing
Adam, and he would not be, like, they're not going to make Ray Palmer the doppelganger of Kal-El.
Right.
You know, so.
Right. I mean, it could happen. I think it's possible. I don't know if it's likely.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's likely at all, but he has said before publicly that he would be willing to guest star on Supergirl. So I love that idea, dude. I had not even thought about that until you just mentioned it. That would be really cool for people like me anyway. Me and Ben Morse, who were big Smallville fans.
So that, you know, that's a cool idea. Let's talk about some stuff that isn't so cool, and that's some of the disappointing news that came out of the Marvel television universe, which is technically part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, even though the Marvel Cinematic Universe never references anything that happens on any television or Netflix shows, but once again, another topic for another day. The news, you know, came out a couple weeks ago that Agent Carter, which, you know, Nick Duke, you have failed this show, apparently, because I still haven't seen an episode, even though I've heard it's good. Due to low ratings, it has been canceled.
Thanks, Nick.
Sorry. And also, the rumored Mockingbird and, what's the character, the guy character?
Lance Hunter.
The Mockingbird and Lance Hunter spinoff of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. entitled Marvel's Most Wanted was not picked up to series by ABC. So ABC is going back to only Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I believe they're also developing a damage control pilot, apparently.
Which the Mockingbird and Lance Hunter show, Marvel's Most Wanted, not getting picked up is the ultimate dick move by ABC television. And let me tell you why, because I know you're not even close to caught up at Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Not even close.
I have been a vocal opponent of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. this season. But part of the reason for that is they awkwardly and clumsily wrote Bobby and Hunter out of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. deliberately so that they could set up their own spinoff show. And they did it in a way that they set up a story, they told a story, and it's not something you can easily write your way out of. They're on the run. They can't work for S.H.I.E.L.D. anymore. They'll find a way out of it now, I'm sure. But basically, you disrupted the entire storytelling dynamic of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And now you're telling them, or they disrupted it themselves. They chose to do that, the writers. But they were trying to set up the show that you told them they were going to get. And now you come in a month or two later and you say, oh, just kidding, we're not gonna allow that show to happen. So now, great, we've got these two awesome characters. In my opinion, by far the two best characters on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. No one else is even in the same stratosphere as them as far as interesting characters go. And now they're not on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. because of this non-existent line that's never going to play out. So it's very unfortunate. I will give Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. this. They got screwed on that because that show was should have happened. Two really interesting characters. I was looking forward to it. But even a bigger bummer than that is that Agent Carter got canceled. And Agent Carter, in my opinion, was leagues better than Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. All the people watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I have no idea why they weren't watching Agent Carter.
I can't speak very intelligently on this topic, having been so far behind on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I will say that from what I saw of last season, I would agree that quickly, I mean, almost within the course of like three or four episodes, Bobby and Hunter became the two best characters on the show.
Yeah.
From my view, almost overnight. It was like a breath of fresh air when they walked through the door.
They're not entangled by the baggage or baggage, as Mean Gene might say, of some of the typical S.H.I.E.L.D. characters, you know, the Coulsons and the Skies and the Mays and all these other characters that are kind of loaded with character baggage at this point. Bobby and Hunter came in with a fresh slate and they were just entertaining, and they came off like the least whiny of the main cast, which is a big problem I have with the show, is everybody is just melodramatic to the point of
disgust.
That it's grating, yeah. But yeah, that's a big disappointment. But Agent Carter, even though I don't think, after thinking it over, I don't think I enjoyed the second season as much as I enjoyed the first season, I still like the second season a lot. And I was really excited to see where they were going moving forward. And it's just a shame that the show got cut off. I understand it from a network perspective because the ratings were really bad for it. But
are the ratings really going to be that much higher for what anything you're going to plug in the mid-season gap?
No.
I mean, like, that's one thing that the mid-season gap has done on network television especially is when you have that forced mid-season break, it pretty much tells people, hey, you don't have to worry about watching our network for 2 months. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it makes no sense.
Constantine arguments. Like, what are you going to put on a Friday night that's gonna do anything, you know? It's like I wish that they had stepped up to bat for it more and just said, you know what, we're not going to get great ratings during this stretch anyway, so let's put something out there that's going to tell a good story, and maybe over the long haul, through word of mouth, you can build a better audience. So I'm really disappointed in that because I thought Agent Carter was excellent. She's great. Haley Atwell. The whole cast of that show was very, very good. So hopefully they'll find a way to integrate her into the Marvel television universe, whether it be in flashbacks with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or I don't know, maybe a Netflix show or something. I don't know, but
I would hope so. But you know, that's some disappointing Marvel news. How about some Marvel news that wasn't disappointing? And this is a little bit old at this point, but I could not resist the urge to talk a little bit.
No. You're talking about the God of Thunder.
Yes, I am. I am of course talking about Thor, and that what you just heard, for those who are not aware, was Greg's famed Jeff Goldblum impression. And the reason he's doing a Jeff Goldblum impression is because freaking Jeff Goldblum is going to be in freaking Thor Ragnarok, which just made, you know, just made my little Mjolnir perk right up.
If you ask me, some people may think that the third Thor movie might not live up to expectations, but I think it's going to Ragnarok. Ragnarok?
In any event, Jeff Goldblum's going to be in the movie. So that's exciting. And he's playing the Grandmaster, who, based on my limited exposure to that character, is more like what the film version of the Collector was in Guardians of the Galaxy than the comics version of the Collector was. So if that doesn't make any sense, let me restate. Guillermo Toro's performance is more akin to what the Grandmaster is like in the comics, in my opinion. So it's an eccentric character that hopefully Jeff Goldblum will be able to put his own eccentric spin on.
Nick, have you ever seen Jeff Goldblum play a non-eccentric character?
I would argue that his Independence Day character wasn't that eccentric.
I mean, he's still eccentric. I mean, Jeff Goldblum is incapable of playing non-eccentric, in my opinion. Even when he's trying to play non-eccentric, it's still Jeff Goldblum. So he's got his Goldblumisms, you know?
He does, and it's awesome, and I can't wait. But, I mean, that's not all. I mean, that movie also announced the casting of Cate Blanchett as the goddess of Hela. We got Carl Urban as Scourge, and we got Tessa Thompson coming off a dynamite performance in Creed playing the big screen version of the Valkyrie. So, I mean, big, big, huge names being attached to that movie now. Characters I'm excited to see portrayed for the first time. I am still a little disappointed that it seems at this point there's practically zero chance of us getting an actual Ragnarok, you know, destruction and disaster porn movie. But if it means I get some Jeff Goldblum, I'll take it.
I'll take it too. Cate Blanchett, obviously award-winning actress, brings a little bit more of that gravity to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Not that it needed much, but
and as badly out of place as it would be, I kind of hope Carl Urban does his Bones voice when he's doing the execution.
Yes. Just do your DeForest Kelly impersonation.
That's a really good DeForest Kelly impersonation, by
the way. Incredible. It's incredible. He needs to do that in the Thor universe. I'd be fine with it. Just like constantly sarcastically referencing whatever's going on around him and just exasperatedly referring to Thor in different ways, you know? Yes. Blaming everything on him the way that he blames everything on Kirk.
Right.
I love it. That's a great idea. And I think that casting announcement, those casting announcements elevated my – I know you were already looking forward to it. It really elevated how much I was looking forward to Ragnarok now. I'm pumped.
Yeah, as am I. I mean, I'm a huge Thor fan, and I'm higher on his two solo movies than most people are. So that one was already high on my list, but this casting just bumps it up even further. And I can't wait, man. It's next November. It'll be here before we know it. So,
and that about brings our rundown to an end. Now this is just the tip of the iceberg, folks, because this has been one of the most jam-packed in terms of news items, periods of months in comics that I can remember in a long time. There's been a lot of stuff going on. What didn't we get to this week? Let us know. Hit us up on Facebook at the Place to Be Nation comics page. Anyone's welcome to join. Hit us on Twitter at gphillips8652 or at nickduke87. Let us know your thoughts on this episode, on the news items we covered, the rumors we covered, stuff that we didn't cover. Let us know. And we are going to get hard to work. Go ahead, Nick.
And, you know, if you were intrigued by our Preacher podcast and you want to try a little Arsface speak yourself, there's been a pretty good thread of comics, true to the comics Arsface discussion going on over there. So,
yes, you know, at the Place to Be Nation comics Facebook page, we've been engaging in an all Arsface comment thread. So you might want to check that out. Shout out to those of you participating in that right now. Feel free to join in at any time.
And those, of course, would be Dova, Jarama. Who else?
Ta.
Ta. I forgot about Ta. And Ta.
So be sure to check that out. We're going to get hard to work in this next week doing something that's just going to be like torture to us, which is rereading Green Lantern Rebirth. As we are getting ready for a long book hunt with
it really is torture, because after the sixth or seventh time, you know, it's only making a couple drops and it's kind of painful and not really like playable at all anymore. So yeah.
Try not to read between the lines too much on that one, folks. But yeah, we're going to be working on Green Lantern Rebirth in many ways, heading into our podcast for next week. Our long book hunt is on that. And we've got some pretty cool things coming down the line. We got some guests coming up down the line. Glenn Butler will be on soon to talk film scores and theme songs.
Right.
Tim Capel will be on soon to help us talk about the first X-Men film. We've got some other surprises for you lined up around the bend. We've got an off the page that I think we're probably going to hit in August. That is, I think, going to be one of the most interesting off the pages we've ever done, which is we're planning on taking a look for the first time at an unfinished and unpublished and unproduced film script, and a pretty prominent one at that. So I think you guys are going to be interested in that episode.
Yeah, that one's going to be interesting, you know, mainly because it's going to challenge us to read a whole lot more than we usually read in preparation for one of these podcasts. So,
yep.
Should be fun.
And with that, we're going to come to another end and hope you join us next week for our talk about Green Lantern Rebirth. And of course, Preacher and all the other things we're watching and reading at a given time, all the DC Rebirth titles. And hit us up. Let us know what you thought. We'll catch you next time, gang.